You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Chris Molina.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. Coming up, a new study finds that Republicans and Democrats are not very good at predicting what voters in the other party think about a variety of issues. We'll find out more about the so-called perception gap.
First, the U.S. House of Representatives passed an appropriations bill last week. Within that funding bill was a measure that aimed to repeal 2001's authorization for use of military force provision.
That law was put into place soon after the attacks of 9/11 and gave then-President Bush the ability to wage war against al-Qaeda and the Taliban without having to first seek congressional approval.
In the 18 years since that act was passed, it has been used by three presidents in very different situations, with tensions between the U.S. and Iran rising, some members of Congress and political observers are afraid that President Trump and his Defense Department might use the original provision to attack Iran without the approval of Congress.
Heather Brandon Smith is the legislative director for Militarism and Human Rights at the Friends Committee on National Legislation. Previously, she served as the Advocacy Counsel for National Security at Human Rights First and is an adjunct professor of law at the Georgetown University Law Center. Heather, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So as we mentioned, the original authority to use military force bill, or AUMF, as a lot of people are truncating it, was passed immediately after 9/11. What specific powers did it give then President Bush that presidents previously didn't have?
Sure. So, yeah, the 2001 AUMF, or as you said, the Authorization for Use of Military Force, that gave then President Bush the power to use force against those who were responsible for the 9/11 attacks, so al-Qaeda, and then those who harbored them, which was the Taliban in Afghanistan.
So, you know, this bill was passed immediately within really the week after the September 11th attacks. Clearly, we were in a time where we weren't sure what was happening, what was going to happen next. But laws like this sometimes seem like they should have a certain shelf life. Was it supposed to end after a certain amount of time, or was it supposed to be put in place indefinitely?
So unfortunately, the law itself doesn't have any sort of time limit. But, you know, it was very clear about what Congress is trying to authorize. You know, they were authorizing the president to use force against those who attacked the U.S. on 9/11 and those who harbored them. And really, that was it. It was certainly was not authorizing this sort of global endless war that we've had, you know, since 2001 for nearly 18 years. It really was supposed to be a limited use of force. And in fact, if you look back at the congressional record, members of Congress who voted for the law, including Jan Schakowsky from Illinois, she specifically said this is intended to be a limited authorization of force only targeted at those who attacked us on 9/11. And also Lamar Smith from Texas, who's a Republican, he said the same thing. You know, this is intended to be a limited authorization for the use of force. It is not this sort of global, you know, forever war statute that it's really become today.
So it's easier to look back and say, you know, people had their issues at the time. You know, looking forward, could members of Congress have put language in place to, you know, really keep this really limited? Or was it always going to sort of be malleable by the executive branch?
Yeah, you know, I don't think it was intended to be malleable by the executive branch. And, you know, that's not what Congress intended. And they certainly could have put limits in place to make sure that that happened. That's really sort of one of the chief failings of the law, something that was intended to be limited and then has been used by the executive branch in an almost limitless way. So one of the limits that could have been in place was they could have been very clear about that it was authorizing force in Afghanistan, which is where al-Qaeda was being harbored by the Taliban. They could have specifically named al-Qaeda and the Taliban in the law instead of just referring to those who attacked the U.S. on 9/11 and those who harbored them. There could have also been a time limit, you know, maybe a 3-year time limit whereupon the authorization would expire. And that would be a forcing function for Congress and the executive branch to come together, look at the state of the wars that are being conducted under it and determine whether or not it should be authorized, you know, whether it should be allowed to expire, whether it should be tweaked, you know, and maybe something could be authorized again, but, you know, something with, you know, clearer limits or, you know, to cover something else. You know, there could have been provisions in there that would have required the executive branch to come back to Congress and for Congress to really debate and consider the scope of the wars that are being conducted under the 2001 AUMF.
So in the 18 years since the AUMF was put on the books, how many times has the president, and there have been three presidents now since then, how many times has it been evoked?
So according to a 2018 Congressional Research Service report, it has been invoked 41 times in 19 countries since 2001. And this includes, you know, wars in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Somalia, Yemen, Libya, Iraq, Syria. It also includes things like detention in Guantanamo Bay. You know, there's still this indefinite detention going on there. We still have 40 people detained there, and all other sorts of operations around the world that have been sort of, you know, shoehorned into this 2001 law.
So playing devil's advocate for a second, you've mentioned a whole host of countries. Geographically, they are not near each other. They're pretty widespread. Is it just simply because the nature of terrorism is what it is and it isn't centralized always in one space? But, you know, we have a pretty wide network of various terroristic groups that, you know, might pose a threat to the United States.
I mean, that's true, and there are no geographic limits in the 2001 AUMF, which, you know, is probably one of its failings, to be honest. At the end of the day, it's really up to Congress to make the determination about when and whether and against whom the U.S. goes to war. So even if there is a new terrorist threat to the United States, then Congress should make that determination about whether we respond to them with a military response. We shouldn't be sort of shoehorning them all into this 2001 law and that is sort of being expanded by executive branch interpretation. This should be something that the president comes to Congress, presents a case for why we need to go to war in a new country against a new group, and Congress makes the considered determination and votes on whether to actually take that action.
We're talking to Heather Brandon Smith right now. She's the legislative director for militarism and human rights at the Friends Committee on National Legislation, and she's with us to talk about the authority to use military force bill. There's a move currently in the House of Representatives in an appropriations bill to basically repeal this law. You know, have there been previous attempts to rescind or restrict the powers the AUMF provides to the president up until now?
There have been, and actually, interestingly, when President Obama was in power, he said that he would support an effort to revise and ultimately repeal the 2001 AUMF. You know, even he recognized that this law should not be on the books forever, and we should really aim to get out of wars and return to a state of peace. So, yeah, there have been other efforts. Really, the biggest champion of this is Representative Barbara Lee from California. So she is the only member of Congress who voted against the 2001 AUMF at the time in 2001. She recognized that it was written in a way that could be manipulated by the executive branch, and she was really the lone person to see that, and she has been proven right over the years. So the amendment to the Defense Appropriations Act that you just mentioned is actually a Barbara Lee amendment that she got through in the committee. So she has been a big proponent of this. Also, on the Senate side, probably Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky is really the biggest proponent of trying to repeal the 2001 AUMF. He introduced an amendment to another piece of legislation 2 years ago, the National Defense Authorization Act, which got 36 votes in favor in the Senate. And, you know, there have also been various proposals by other members of Congress to either repeal the 2001 AUMF or to, you know, refine it by sort of repealing it and replacing it with something narrower, something with a sunset, you know, an expiration date. So, for example, Representative Elliot Engel, who is the chair of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, introduced a bill a few years ago. Representative Adam Schiff in the House has also introduced legislation. Ruben Gallego, Jimmy Panetta have introduced proposals. On the Senate side as well, Senator Tim Kaine is a big proponent of Congress really retaking their constitutional authority over matters of war. So he's done a lot of work trying to repeal the 2001 AUMF and replace it with something else. And then also there is Senator Merkley, who introduced an AUMF proposal last year, which would have, you know, significantly narrowed the operations where the U.S. is using force. And what it would have also done was require the president to come back to Congress if they wanted to use force in a new country or against a new group. And Congress would have had to affirmatively vote in order for that to go forward, whereas now we're in this situation where the president just adds a new group and says, hey, this is authorized by the 2001 AUMF, and that is really problematic. I mean, now we're in the situation where, as you mentioned in your intro, that you know the administration is posturing it using the 2001 AUMF to attack Iran. It's really troubling and really something needs to be done. So it was really a fantastic development to see the House pass that repeal of the 2001 AUMF. And, you know, we hope that the rest of Congress will follow suit.
And we are going to talk about Iran in just a minute. But right now we're talking with Heather Brandon Smith about the 2001 authorization for use of military force provision and whether the Trump administration may use it to justify actions against Iran. She's the legislative director for militarism and human rights at the Friends Committee on National Legislation. We started talking a little bit about some murmurs about Iran on June 16th. Secretary of Defense Mike Pompeo was asked on CBS's Face the Nation whether the president could order a strike on Iran without congressional approval. Here's what he had to say.
We always have the authorization to defend American interests. Remember, they now have attacked U.S. aircraft. They, on June 6th, there was a missile fired from Yemen that we assess had Iranian assistance that took down an MQ-9 aircraft. These are attacks on fundamental international norms and now on American interests, and we always have the right.
So Pompeo is saying that, you know, the president has the right to do this. I guess a pretty basic question is, under the AUMF, does he?
The short answer to that is no. So the 2001 AUMF is very clear about who it authorizes force against. You know, it's Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. It is not Iran. Iran has, no connection to the 9/11 attacks. So to try and claim that this 18-year-old law somehow authorizes force against a new country today is really quite breathtaking. And, you know, hopefully Congress will step in and make very clear that that is not the case.
And what else have we heard from the Trump administration that there could be maybe some retaliation against Iran?
So we've been hearing some sort of murmurs about some sort of retaliation from the Trump administration. I mean, recently, President Trump said that he called off a planned strike against Iran. And, you know, if that is the case, then it is very good that that never took place because, as we were discussing, the president does not have authorization from Congress to be able to undertake that strike. So even though the administration is posturing like this and trying to present some sort of case that it has authority from Congress already to do this, it certainly does not. And members of Congress are speaking up to confirm that view and to say that the president is not authorized to undertake a strike against Iran.
And one of those members of the House was House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. She had this to say about the use of the AUMF specifically in relation to Iran.
And the responsibility in the Constitution is for Congress to declare war. So I hope that the president's advisors recognize that they have no authorization to go forward in any way. They cannot call the authorization, AUMF, the authorization for the use of military force that was passed in 2001 as any authorization to go forward in the Middle East now.
Are we hearing more of this from members of Congress?
We are, and we're even seeing some proposals from members of Congress that specifically say that the president does not have authority from Congress to attack Iran. So currently there are amendments to the National Defense Authorization Act in both the House and the Senate that make that very clear, and then they also prohibit the president from using funds to strike Iran. So members of Congress are becoming more and more engaged on this, and you know they're taking action, which is a really important step.
I want to go to one of our callers right now. We have Jim in Racine. Hi, Jim. What do you want to say?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I do not want to see American troops in Iran. We've been war planning against Iran for decades, and it's not going to happen. It's going to take too many military personnel. We're talking in the millions, resources. If you look at Iran geographically, it's a nightmare militarily. So we're probably never going to actually invade Iran. More likely, they're going to do airstrikes, more sanctions, things like that. I just hope things get a lot better over time. I don't know if Trump...
Jim, thank you for that call. And so, Heather, thinking back about what Jim said, that there are big logistical issues facing this, you know, how do we talk about war now in a way that we didn't in the past and how it might be applicable to this conversation?
Well, I think, yeah, one of the things that Jim mentioned there is that, you know, we might undertake airstrikes, but we might not, you know, go forward with a full ground war. Airstrikes are still acts of war, and they still need to be approved by Congress. So this is not something that the president has the authority unilaterally to do by himself. He still needs to go to Congress. So I think this is a kind of a different way that we're talking about war, but at the end of the day, we're still bombing a country. You know, we're still conducting acts of war, and the Constitution gives Congress the power to decide when the U.S. goes to war. So that's still something that, you know, the president needs to go back to Congress to get their authorization to do.
We're talking to Heather Brandon Smith. She is the legislative director for militarism and human rights at the Friends Committee on National Legislation. We're talking about the AUMF. And as we said earlier, the Democrat-controlled House included a provision repealing the 2001 authorization for use of military force law in an appropriations bill. Naturally, that is a Democrat-controlled part of Congress. It heads to the Republican-controlled Senate. What do you think is going to happen there?
Yeah, so there are many ways, actually, that this could become law. So at the end of the day, the Senate's going to do their own version of the Defense Appropriations Bill. That might include a provision to repeal the 2001 AUMF, but if it doesn't, we're not at the end of the line there, because the Senate and the House will come together and, you know, they will conference about and try and reconcile these two pieces of legislation. So there is still hope that the 2001 AUMF repeal provision in the House version of the bill will still make it through to the final bill that passes that the Senate and the House sort of negotiate. That being said, there are also other opportunities to repeal the 2001 AUMF. So right now, I mentioned that Senator Rand Paul is a big champion of AUMF repeal. It's been reported that he is looking to offer an amendment just this week on the National Defense Authorization Act that would also repeal the 2001 AUMF. So there's also possibly some movement happening in the House on the National Defense Authorization Act. And there are also sort of standalone bills that are out there. So Barbara Lee has a standalone bill that would repeal the 2001 AUMF, which currently has 70 co-sponsors in the House. So there are all different sorts of vehicles that might move forward that get us that final vote where we have all of Congress supporting repeal of that law.
So if it were to be repealed, what would the president's authority then be?
So, yeah, so the way that the provision in the Defense Appropriations Act is structured is that it wouldn't be an immediate repeal. The 2001 AUMF would be repealed after 8 months. So the president would still have 8 months of having that authority still in place to conduct current operations. But during those 8 months, that would give Congress the time to really look at what's going on all around the world and all these conflicts that we're in, you know, to demand more transparency from the administration, you know, and sort of work with them about what's going on and make the determination about whether it wants to authorize continued participation in any current conflict. And so it would really be after that 8 months that we would sort of know what was happening going forward.
Heather, thank you so much for shining a light on this issue, which is a very, very big conversation. So thank you so much for taking your time to talk to us today.
Sure, my pleasure.
Heather Brandon Smith is the Legislative Director for Militarism and Human Rights at the Friends Committee on National Legislation. She joined us to talk about the 2001 Authorization for Use of Military Force provision, and we talked about concerns from some political watchers and members of Congress that the Trump administration may use it to justify actions against Iran.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Chris Molina.
And I'm Jay Carlisle-Larson.
Our polarized politics can make it seem easy to assume what people we disagree with are thinking about some of the big issues of the day. But some new research shows that these assumptions may not actually match up with reality.
A new study from the group More in Common asked Democrats and Republicans what they thought voters on the other side felt about a variety of topics. The results showed people assumed other voters had more extreme viewpoints than they actually did, creating what researchers are calling a perception gap.
Dan Vallone is the director of More in Common USA, and he joins us now to talk about the results of his recent experiment. Dan, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Chris. Hi, Jay. Great to be here. Thank you for inviting me on.
You bet. So what got you interested in looking at whether or not the way people with different political views, the way it lines up with reality? What got you wanting to explore this topic?
Sure, absolutely. So last fall in October, More in Common published a report called Hidden Tribes, a study of America's polarized landscape. And in it, we kind of divided the country into seven different population segments and found that although most of the country falls into what we consider the exhausted majority, about a third of Americans fell into one of three more ideological groups on the left and the right that we call the wings. And these ideological groups have very negative views towards each other, and they are the most active groups on politics and in media. And so as we were doing that research and we found that level of animosity across these ideological segments, we said, well, we wanted to know why. What is it that is driving that level of negativity towards other Americans? And so that the Perception Gap report started as an effort to better understand, well, let's step back and ask them, what do you think a Republican actually believes? Or what do you think a Democrat actually believes? And over time, we actually broadened it out to just engage a representative sample of the American population in total, try and find out what do Democrats think about Republicans' beliefs and vice versa.
So we kind of just got into the definition of the perception gap there, and we'll get into some specific issues in just a second. But just in general, what did you find about how good or how bad people are about predicting what people that identify with a different party actually believe?
So the kind of disappointing news is we're actually all pretty bad at it. So we dramatically exaggerate the proportion of our political opponents who hold extreme views. And I should just say that by extreme views, this is not More in Common's assessment of what constitutes an extreme view. But, you know, we have polling and survey data showing kind of what are the views that Democrats and Republicans have almost 100% support for. And so would view the opposite as an extreme idea. So, for example, for Democrats, we know that someone not supporting any immigration whatsoever would be considered an extreme viewpoint. And for Republicans, we know that the belief that law-abiding citizens should not have the right to own a firearm would be considered extreme. So we use the definition of extreme that comes from the political groups themselves. And we found that everybody, Americans on average, almost estimate their estimate of the number of people who have extreme views is almost double reality, and that the more partisan you are, the more inaccurate your understanding of the other side is. And we can dig into some of the specifics because the story is actually a little different for Democrats and versus Republicans. And so although in total everybody has a misguided understanding, there are specifics that are really interesting.
Well, let's dig into that then. Let's start with how Democrats are perceiving Republican voters. When you look at that specifically, what were some of the issues where the perception gap was really stark for Democrats perceiving Republicans?
Yeah, absolutely. So the issue area that the Democrats are most inaccurate is immigration. And so Democrats believe that only 52%, so about only half of Republicans, support properly controlled immigration as a positive thing for America. So basically, the Democrats believe only half of Republicans support any kind of immigration, when in reality, the number is much closer to 85% of Republicans support properly controlled immigration for America. Similarly, Democrats believe only 41% of Republicans think that most Muslims are good people, when in reality, 70% of Republicans support this view. So those are just two of eight samples, but that's where Democrats' views on Republicans were the widest and most inaccurate. It's interesting, just a quick caveat, where Democrats are most accurate regarding Republicans is around support for President Trump. So Democrats, and we asked a question basically, what percentage of Republicans do you think believe Donald Trump is a flawed person? And so Democrats believe 47% of Republicans think Donald Trump is a flawed person. In reality, 48% of Republicans think he's a flawed person. So basically spot on when it comes to approval of belief around Donald Trump being flawed.
Let's flip the parties around now and talk about Republicans and how they perceive Democrats. Where did we see some stark differences there?
Yep. So kind of not too surprising, given what we hear in the headlines, the issue that Republicans were very inaccurate on was also immigration. And so we asked Republicans, what percentage of Democrats do you think want completely open borders? And Republicans thought that 62% of Democrats want completely open borders, when in reality, only 29% actually support that position. So that's almost double in terms of inaccuracy. Where Republicans were most accurate is on Democrats' feelings towards ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency. So Republicans think that 60% of Democrats want to abolish ICE. In reality, 47% of Democrats support that position. So that's a smaller perception gap. We did find overall that Republicans had a slightly higher perception gap relative to Democrats, but not by a substantial margin.
We're talking right now with Dan Vallone. He is the director of More in Common USA. We're talking about how we perceive the political views of people that we don't necessarily agree with might actually be different than what they are in reality. And one of the things that you looked at in this report, I think this was really interesting, one of the tribes, you call them, are the politically disengaged. And one might think, okay, you're politically disengaged. The perception gap is going to be a little bit larger because, you know, you might not be paying attention to some of these issues. But you found out it's kind of the opposite, that the individuals who are politically disengaged actually had a smaller perception gap. Can you talk about what you found and what's behind that?
Absolutely. And it is a really interesting finding that the politically disengaged, like you said, I mean, this is the population segment that is least active politically, least active civically. So, you know, we ask questions about things like going to church, donating to charity, giving blood, and that is how we categorize these population segments. And so the politically disengaged are very not active in any sense, and yet they have the most accurate understanding of political views on both sides. And the groups that are most active, the ones who consume the most news, who are active in politics, who are active in civic life, have the largest perception gaps. And so, you know, we don't have the data to make a firm finding in terms of what exactly is causing this, but we did ask about things like media consumption and like social circles. And the politically disengaged, which is kind of, at an intuitive level, you might think like, yeah, this makes sense. The politically disengaged, because they're not active in politics, they actually tend to have more diverse social circles. They tend to have friends who might lean right and lean left. And so they're forming their political assessment not on the basis of what they see on TV or hear necessarily on the radio, but actually what someone has told them or what somebody they know has said. Whereas if you're more politically active, and this is particularly true for Democrats, the probability of you having someone in your social circle that has a different political viewpoint drops dramatically. And so people are forming their perceptions of the other side essentially purely on the basis of what they see in media. And we found a significant kind of association between active media consumption and inaccuracy in views, meaning that the people who consumed the least media, people who said, I don't watch the news at all, really, were much more accurate than those who said, I consume media most or all of the time.
So as someone who works for a media organization, this is a finding that can sound kind of depressing to hear, but you also kind of look at, you know, there's a big difference in the amount of media that's out there and where people are getting their information from. How does this break down when you look at the different varieties of media sources that are out there?
Yes, no, absolutely. And it's a great point. It's important because I think one of our overall conclusions from this research is that it's actually really important to have a diverse media diet, to try and intentionally sample different media sources that have different viewpoints and really be skeptical of any media source that makes easy generalizations about a political group or any kind of group in general. And so what we did find, and you know, our survey partner, YouGov, has 13 different categories of media, everything from kind of far-right sources like Drudge Report, Breitbart News, all the way to things like network TV news, ABC, CBS, NBC, local radio and television, everything in between. And we did find that most 12 out of 13 categories of media were associated with increases in perception gaps. So people were more inaccurate, but there were very stark differences in terms of how much an increase in perception gap was associated with media. And we found that the kind of more conservative news outlets were associated with the largest jumps in perception gap, and that things like local television and radio, things like WPR, were associated with an increase in perception gap, but that it was relatively small, under 5 percentage points. And things like ABC, CBS, NBC were actually associated with a decrease in perception gap. So network TV news seems to have some sort of effect of making people more accurate in terms of understanding the other side. So all media is not equal when it comes to perception gap, but it does underscore the point of having a diverse media diet.
You know, we live in a world where, you know, we're kind of in our filter bubbles on social media. We're not always surrounded by people we think, you know, who may have political differences than our own. So what else can we do to really branch out and help close this perception gap on an individual level for all of us?
Yeah, I think so. It's a great question. And to be honest, I mean, this is one of a large conversation that More in Common is a part of, and that I think we all kind of have to engage in as we think about what are the responsibilities of being a citizen in a democracy in an era of social media, in an era of when it's so easy to manipulate video and share content that is not based in reality. And so I think adopting a mindset of active, you know, scrutiny of any media sources is part of that responsibility. But another key thing is, to the extent it is possible, to actively broaden social circles as well. And again, this is more of an issue for Democrats. We found that with Democrats, but not Republicans, there is, as Democrats achieve higher levels of education, they report smaller proportions of Republicans in their social circles. So a Democrat with a postgraduate degree is nearly twice as likely as a Democrat with a high school degree to say that almost all their friends hold similar political views. And kind of unsurprisingly, that category of Democrat with a postgraduate degree has the most inaccurate picture of Republican views. So it really is important to actively go out and talk to real people before you form an assessment of what any political party believes. And so that's another component of like what we as citizens need to do in this new era.
Briefly, Dan, how do you plan on following this research up going forward?
Yeah, so this is part of a long-term project for us to try and elevate the importance of breaking through misperceptions and bridging lines of difference to try and better understand each other. And so we're working with a range of partners to do both on-the-ground initiatives that help bring people together from diverse backgrounds, but then also to try and create alternative online and kind of a digital platforms that share accurate, more informed content and are based in kind of a more fact-based foundation. And so there are already existing things like allsides.com that are trying to bridge this gap and reduce perception gaps, and we're hoping to help elevate that. And I just want to close by saying the consequences of these perception gaps are real and harmful. One of the other questions we asked is about judgments of people on the other side, and we found that more than 8 in 10 Democrats and Republicans refer to people on the other side as brainwashed and hateful, and at the same time, over 9 in 10 of both parties say that members of their own party are honest and reasonable. So with that kind of disconnect, we have a real problem on our hands in terms of how do we move our country forward.
And we're going to have to leave it there. Dan, thank you for joining us. That was Dan Vallone, director of More in Common USA, talking with us about the group's new study, The Perception Gap.
A federal job center in Wisconsin's Northwoods became a political battleground after the Trump administration announced and then backed away from plans to close it down. For the young people enrolled there, the Blackwell Job Corps Center isn't just a training site. It's a chance for them to improve their lives. Rob Menser reports.
Jacqueline Hernandez knew she wanted to help people.
When I was in high school, I would volunteer in hospitals. So it's been my thing.
Hernandez is 22. She's from Milwaukee. She started college but dropped out. For a while, she worked at a retail job that she didn't like.
My life was just in a big pause.
Applying at the Blackwell Job Corps Center was her way to get unstuck. She enrolled in the federal job training program for disadvantaged young people and in January started courses at the center in Leona. Hernandez is now 6 months into a program that would make her a certified nursing assistant.
It was like, okay, another door, you know, an opportunity. So I like to say it was like the light at the end of my tunnel.
For a while, it seemed like she would lose the opportunity. Over Memorial Day weekend, the Trump administration announced plans to close or privatize the nation's job centers, laying off more than 1,000 federal workers and shuttering the 55-year-old Blackwell facility. It would have forced Hernandez and about 70 other young people to leave the program or transfer elsewhere. Those plans met with bipartisan opposition in Congress, and on Wednesday, the Trump administration announced that the center will stay open after all. On a tour of the Northwoods Center, Hernandez and other students talked about what Blackwell means to them.
Over here we have our welders.
Andrew Jameson Duncan is 22 and in the campus's welding program. He's from Minnesota. Before he came to Blackwell, he had been homeless for 8 months and sleeping in the woods.
Police came, got me, gave me a brochure for this place, and I came over here because it was the best thing for me.
Another welding student, Alberto Romero from Beloit, said he learned about the program in the Wisconsin National Guard Challenge Academy.
To me, it was like heaven. I wanted to come here.
The next stop on Hernandez's tour is a computer lab.
Here, go ahead.
Students are studying for their high school equivalency diplomas. Some students, like Hernandez, have graduated by the time they come to Blackwell. But the center also takes students as young as 16 who haven't finished high school. TJ Cole is 17. He's from central Wisconsin, about an hour and a half away from the site. He was never great in school, he said, and he came to Blackwell after his vice principal recommended it.
You know, at first I was a bit hesitant to come over here for like the first couple of months, but eventually once you get used to the people, you know, you find out this is an awesome program with amazing people, staff, and students overall, and I'm so glad I came here.
Christy Caudell is president of a federal workers union representing Blackwell employees. She was at the center when the news broke that the Trump administration would keep Blackwell open. She said organization made the difference.
We banded together across all of the CCCs across the nation, along with the community members, the forestry, and the congressmen stepping up and saying, this can't be done. It will be detrimental to these communities.
For Hernandez, the weeks of uncertainty were hard. She felt like her life had been put back on pause. Reached by phone not long after she learned that Blackwell would stay open, she said things were back on track. And she's not the only one who feels that way.
I've actually had a couple conversations with, like, you know, students and with me and my trade. And they're like, okay, I can finally get back on what I was doing. I can finally do what I want, what I came here for, you know?
Caudell said the fight to protect Job Corps isn't over. Her group plans to push for a law that would require Congress to approve any closures instead of leaving it up to the discretion of cabinet secretaries. For today's Blackwell students, though, the news means they can get back to their courses, get their certifications, find a job and a trade. After all, that's what they went there to do. Rob Menser, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, as we approach the first two Democratic debates, we'll ask if debates still matter and how they can be done well with so many candidates involved.
That's coming up tomorrow right here on Central Time.
Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow after 8, Patty Hirsch from NPR's Planet Money joins Kate to talk about the latest economic news, including the latest data on home ownership in America. That's tomorrow after 8, right here on the Ideas Network.
Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and WPR, and then we'll talk about some of the biggest HR issues in the workplace today and how bosses and workers can best deal with them. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson.
And I'm Chris Molina. This is Central Time.
Hi, I'm Mike Crane, director of Wisconsin Public Radio. As our budget year comes to a close, I look back on another year of great programming. The news that keeps us informed, the ideas that inspire us, the weekend shows that make us laugh, it's all possible thanks to listener support. There's still so much good work to do, and you can help. Make your gift at WPR.org. Thanks.
Wisconsin Public Television has been part of the educational infrastructure of the state since its beginning, on television, in the classroom, and in the community. With the launch of the new website, wisconsinfirstnations.org, they continue their mission to engage and inspire individuals to grow through learning. Lesson plans, videos, professional development opportunities, and more resources are available at wisconsinfirstnations.org.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. The acting commissioner of Customs and Border Protection will resign in coming weeks as his agency comes under fire for its treatment of detained immigrant families and children.